Appeals is now in session. Judge Reyes, Judge Bratful, Judge Gaitas, the Honorable Peter M. Reyes Jr. presiding.
Good morning. You may be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Wednesday, July 12th, 2023. We have three cases on our calendar today. Two are set for oral argument, the first of which is A23-0031, Tanya May Wagner et al., on behalf of themselves and all others similarly situated, versus the Minnesota Department of Corrections. Counsel for appellants, you will have 15 minutes for your initial arguments, followed by 15 minutes by respondent, and then 5 minutes for rebuttal by appellant, if you so choose. There's a podium in the middle, and there is a button underneath that you can raise and lower the podium. You can also adjust the microphone. And when you approach the podium, please state your name for the record and the party that you are representing. And finally, we'd like to welcome all the guests that are here. I know that there are a number of people here, students, as well as some very young students, I believe, who are 8 years old, who are thinking about becoming lawyers themselves. So we are delighted to have you here. We hope you find this informative and educational. And counsel, with that, you may begin.
May it please the court, my name is Corrine Wright, and I represent the Minnesota Department of Corrections. This case arose against the backdrop of extraordinary circumstances, the COVID-19 pandemic, but the legal principles at issue here are not unusual, and they're well established. All that the respondents were entitled to under the conditional medical release statute was an administrative process, and they received that process. There is nothing left for the district court to do in this case. Their claims are moot. And to the extent that the respondents wanted to challenge any part of that process, whether it was the commissioner's findings, the commissioner's reasoning for his findings, or even the process that the commissioner used, the appropriate vehicle would be a writ of habeas corpus. So a writ of habeas corpus is the correct way to challenge the commissioner's, any kind of administrative decision the commissioner makes relative to administering sentences, and importantly, revoking or rescinding release.
But is it the decision itself by the commissioner that's being challenged? My understanding is that it is the process that is being used, not the ultimate decision itself.
And the process is also, you would challenge the process as well in a habeas petition. So in the Minnesota Supreme Court in State v. Schnagel laid out that habeas was the proper mechanism to challenge administrative decisions relating to sentence administration, and that included the process.
Doesn't the Leslie decision, doesn't that control and lay out the process and lay out that a civil action has to be brought, including having the process for seeking a temporary restraining order? Isn't that the case that's controlling here?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I believe, and I will go back to the reply brief, but I believe Leslie was distinguished because Leslie involved a criminal court, and we're in a civil court below. So I can certainly look at the way that we...
But Leslie talks about, it says, in a civil action and following the Minnesota Rules of Civil Procedure, the defendant could have served and filed a complaint, et cetera, et cetera. And in a civil action, it could have sought a speedy remedy, such as a temporary restraining order under Rule 6501 or a temporary injunction under Rule 6502.
Certainly, Your Honor, I'm not saying that this should never have been in district court. I think that the temporary restraining order in district court was appropriate at the time, because what the respondents needed to do was say to someone, we deserve an administrative process here, and it looks like we are being ordered back to prison without one. And I think the only way they could do that, arguably, was at the district court. But that they were saying, we need an administrative process. And so the TRO went into place, and there were two things I think the department could do at that point. They could argue in district court, we're not required to do a process under this statute, or they could provide a process, and that's exactly what they did. Once they provided that process, that's really out of the district court's hands. It's out of the
Doesn't the district court still have authority, though, to decide whether or not the process that had been engaged in by the Department of Corrections did meet constitutional muster?
I think that the court can decide whether or not a process was required under the statute. But just like any other administrative agency, I think that if someone challenges the process that an administrative agency used to come to an administrative decision, that is not challenged in a district court. That's challenged here at the Court of Appeals, either through a Chapter 14 cert appeal or a common law cert appeal. But certainly, unless there's a statutory grant by the legislature that would tell the district court that they can review an administrative agency's process for both the reasoning, the adequacy, and the constitutionality of that, that is something that would come up to this court on a cert appeal, and it would say, I don't think that that process was constitutional. And certainly when you're ordered back to prison, the habeas court will look at that and look at the process, and the habeas court always looks at, often looks at constitutional questions. That's typically what's in front of a habeas court. Putting habeas aside, there are really important, I think we're getting to them, really important separation of powers issues here. So even without looking at habeas and just thinking about an administrative process and a commissioner's or an agency's final administrative decision, unless the legislature says that a district court should be reviewing that, they shouldn't be. There's just no subject matter jurisdiction for the district court to be reviewing an agency process or an agency decision. And I think the legislature was very clear that it expected the commissioner to have some discretion, not unfettered discretion, but certainly some discretion. And the conditional medical release statute clearly states that they can be rescinded without a hearing, but it doesn't lay out exactly what that process looks like, right? So that is the commissioner's, that's within the commissioner's discretion. But again, it's not unfettered, and it can be challenged. I'm just saying that it shouldn't be challenged in district court. The way that works is that the final order would say you must go back to prison, and then at that point, while you're in prison, you can challenge the process that put you there. I mean, habeas is the right vehicle, both in that situation and then generally for challenging the fact that you're incarcerated or the length of your incarceration.
That also seems contrary to Leslie, because the Supreme Court said that the district court did retain subject matter jurisdiction because of the original jurisdiction that it has for a claim by a citizen against a public official.
But in Leslie, do we have an administrative process and a final administrative decision? I feel like that's where, and I don't mean to be asking you a question, that's more of I'm kind of begging the question. But I think, I don't think Leslie is on all fours, at least not relative to the situation we have before us. And this situation, the Department of Corrections will agree, is just kind of a unicorn. I think in hindsight, you know, certainly individual determinations to tell people that they were having their CMR rescinded would have been, we probably wouldn't have been in district court at all, or at least the challenge in district court would have been less jurisdictionally kind of knotted up here. You know, there is a little bit of a jurisdictional pickle, and part of that is because I think it probably should have started where it started. I don't know that the respondents had any other way. I mean, that's where the emergency injunction needed to be.
And if that's the case, and I appreciate that acknowledgement, that concession, but if that's the case, why shouldn't we allow the district court to continue to evaluate whether or not the procedure that the department engaged in met the constitutional due process requirements? That is a question that district courts do have authority to decide.
So I guess my question would be, if the district court is doing that, then how are they not making determinations and decisions and evaluations about the commissioner's process and the commissioner's reasoning? And I think the district court seems like it may want to go there. And I think as a separation of powers concern, that's problematic. So for instance, in the record, you'll see in the order where they'll say, well, I don't know how the commissioner got from A to B to C. Like, this doesn't really make sense. And to me, that's like, okay, so now we have a district court who's evaluating how an agency is reasoning and making decisions and fact-finding.
But won't you have an opportunity to challenge that down the line? You know, and once we've seen what the district court actually does in this case, won't you have the ability to appeal the decision that's ultimately made on a claim?
I mean, I think the argument though, would still be the same, which is that it should have never been in district court. If it moves through district court and the district court starts making evaluations and decisions about the administrative process, I mean, our argument would be the same. It's like it should never have been here.
But I thought you just conceded that it was appropriate at the outset for the complaint to be filed in this matter in the district court.
I think it was, the district court was a place to bring the TRO, only because I honestly can't think of another way that respondents could have said, please, I shouldn't have to go back to prison. You should follow the statute. But once that happened, once the process, they said, we need a process. That's even still in their amended complaint. They're looking for an administrative process. And once we had an administrative process in place and final decisions were made, I'm saying the district court's job is done. They certainly were there to look at the statute and say, no, I think the statute calls for process. But I don't think the district court should be saying, well, now I want to see what your process looks like. I'm not sure it's so good. But I just don't, that to me seems like we need to cut off, where the district court is involved at this point.
You seem to overlook the Delbrook factors, though, to a certain extent. I mean, I realize that you challenge them and you challenge the key one in particular, but mm-hmm. Do you agree that the Delbrook factors apply in this case?
They apply to the TRO.
Okay.
Yep.
And if the TRO is a temporary restraining order, and a temporary restraining order is put in place so the district court can take a look at whether, and in particular, whether or not there are merits to the underlying claim, but that's just a precursor for the district court to look at the underlying claims and determine whether or not they actually do have merit. Wouldn't you agree that's part of the process?
It is part of the process.
Okay, so if that's the case, then why shouldn't we allow the district court to continue that process and look at whether or not, my understanding is they're not challenging the end result, the ultimate decision. And they can speak to that, but it seems that they're more focused on whether or not the process is adequate under the due process clause of the Constitution.
So I think your question then is why shouldn't the district court?
The question is why shouldn't we allow the district court to continue that analysis?
If that is truly all the district, I guess my answer is that they received process. I just don't know what's left for the district court to do.
Well, let me put it this way. Yeah. What is required under due process typically?
Notice and an opportunity to be heard.
And I think that's what they're challenging, is that they didn't receive proper notice and they didn't have an opportunity to be heard. And the district court acknowledged that it's not sure how strong those claims actually are, but at least it appears that they have a doubtful claim of some kind. And then the question is, okay, how, at this stage, it's just meeting that threshold requirement, but then it needs to get to the point where the district court actually makes a decision as to whether or not those claims even have merit or whether or not the process that had been provided was sufficient under the Constitution.
And I would say that there is a clear mechanism for a court to make a decision about whether the process was adequate. And it's a writ of habeas corpus. A final decision has been made. And the decision was you need to report back to prison. And the place that you challenge that is from prison in a petition for habeas corpus. And I know it seems maybe not fair, but all of these folks are still serving their term of imprisonment. They're not out on supervised release. They are still serving their first two-thirds. This is how their prison administration works.
You raise a good point. I want to ask a question. I'm going to ask counsel for response this question, too. What is the current status quo?
My answer would be the current status quo is that they're serving their term of imprisonment.
Are they in prison?
They are not, and they should be.
Where are they right now?
They're out in the community.
Okay, and they are under CMR?
Yes.
Which is?
This is probably not important for this point, but another respondent has now transitioned over, just so you know. So the remaining folks, I think there's three, are on conditional medical release.
Okay.
Yep.
So they are on conditional medical release, so they're not in prison right now.
Right.
How do you respond to the cases that have been cited by respondents that where when a person has been given some type of liberty or property interest, and then the state seeks to take away that liberty or property interest. And there are a number of cases, including the Supreme Court, I think one is from the Sixth Circuit, others.
So I think the sort of the North Star here would be Morrissey. And I think folks talk about whether or not you need Morrissey process or Morrissey hearing. And I think the respondent's argument is that they do, right? That under the statute or under constitutional law, they deserve a Morrissey. And I'd say that Young is a case that they rely on, but I look at Young and say that that's easily distinguishable and actually goes back to kind of supports our position. And that's in Young, folks had no notice. They had no idea. They thought they were just kind of out in the community, and they had no idea that there were parameters, right, other than their kind of traditional conditions of release. And here these folks all knew when they were released during COVID that this was COVID-specific, that when COVID-19 abated, and when there were vaccines or treatments available, that they would be required to come back to prison to serve. So there's an expectancy. Morrissey is about what your expectancy is, and so isn't Young. And the other thing about Morrissey that's really important is that we're talking about parole and whether or not you can be revoked from parole. And here in Minnesota, you bet you get a Morrissey hearing if you're going to get revoked from your supervised release, because that is that one-third you're guaranteed by the statute to be serving out in the community. You have a liberty interest there. And Carrillo, our Minnesota Supreme Court in Carrillo even said, you have a liberty interest in your supervised release date. That's Morrissey process. There's no question. But here you have people not serving. They're still serving their first two-thirds. And they knew what the expectancy was. They were on notice. They understood what this was about. And even if the statute, which I will agree is a little opaque and kind of hard to understand, you understand that the statute puts some road, you know, there's some guidelines there. And I see that my time is up. I apologize for, I can answer more questions in rebuttal.
Thank you. And you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondents, please state your name for the record and the party you are representing. You may.
Good morning, Your Honors. Jane Ann Murray for the respondents. Joining me at counsel table is Elizabeth Bentley and Daniel Shulman. Your Honor, as the DOC has conceded in their opening argument, the district court had jurisdiction to issue the TRO that is at issue on this appeal. This was the only mechanism the DOC sees by which my clients could go into court and say, stop me being returned to prison, stop my CMR from being revoked. And so going into district court was an appropriate venue for us with respect to that stage. The court issued the TRO. Now the DOC wants that TRO rescinded. They claim that because they stopped and gave us a new process, a new individualized process, that therefore we got exactly the relief we were seeking, and so the case is now over. This mootness argument presupposes that we got the relief we were seeking. To be clear, we weren't looking for any process. We weren't looking for any kind of individualized process. We were looking for the process dictated by the CMR statute and guided by the Due Process Clause of the Constitution. And to be clear, the CMR statute incorporates the Due Process Clause in Subdivision 2 of the statute. And that process is very clear in the statute. I disagree respectfully with my colleague here that it's opaque or ambiguous. It's very clear. First, there is a finding in order to release them that they are not a threat to the community and they have a grave, serious medical condition. But once they're out, and our position is at that point, our clients have both a liberty and a property interest in their new status, which is not completely being out in the community, to be clear. They're on home confinement. Ms. Wagner, for example, is at home most of the day, and she's at home with her baby, who's now about 18 months, and she's out for legal events, court events, medical events, and you know, mental health treatment and training. But they're very limited in the freedom that they have. They are still confined at home. I just wanted to make that clear for the record. But the We submit they have, because it's such a dramatic difference between being on home confinement and being in prison, we submit they have a liberty interest in their current status, and they also have a property interest granted to them by the CMR statute, which says you cannot have this revoked unless you get a hearing, or without a hearing, there has to be a determination that your medical condition has improved and you are now a more serious threat to society. So that's the only limited exception that allows the DOC to revoke CMR without a hearing is if the DOC makes that finding. That was the process we sought in our complaint yesterday.
But even though due process requires notice and a hearing, it doesn't necessarily require a hearing per se. There can be something else other than an actual hearing. So why isn't what the DOC has now provided subsequent with the notice, and this is what we're looking for, you can submit as much information as you want, affidavits, whatever, go at it. Why isn't that sufficient to overcome the Dahlberg factor of success on the merits?
Potentially that process could have been sufficient, but the evidence from what we have seen is that it wasn't sufficient. And certainly the district court wasn't satisfied that that process was sufficient to meet the dictate under the CMR
statute. I'm not
sure
the district court said it wasn't sufficient to satisfy. In fact, I think the district court had some serious doubts as to whether or not there is even a viable claim anymore, given the process that the DOC had engaged in.
What the court said in its decision not to lift the TRO was that it wasn't clear how the DOC went from point A to point B to point C. In other words, it wasn't clear how, with the information before them, they made the finding that indeed this person had an improved medical condition and, in fact, was also now a more serious threat to society. So the court said it was unclear. That was the word the court used.
Right, and then the next sentence or two by the district court seems like a conclusory statement of it's doubtful without providing any findings or substance to support that conclusory statement. Why isn't that an error by the district court in terms of that because that factor is one of the most important ones?
Well, our position is that there was enough evidence here to suggest that the DOC didn't follow the statute. For example, as we laid out to the court, the standard they appeared to apply was not simply that the medical condition had intrinsically improved, but rather that the calculus about the medical condition had changed vis-a-vis vaccines and treatments and available treatments. And so there wasn't a find. It seemed, based on the materials filed by the DOC, that they didn't actually follow the statute. The statute doesn't say your medical condition is less concerning now because of availability of treatments. The statute says your medical condition has improved.
Why hasn't the medical condition improved if the COVID pandemic, which is the reason that CMR was granted, has in fact changed?
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I would say that the statute, the CMR statute, requires a finding that the person have a serious or grave illness. And so that finding was obviously made with respect to the individuals who got CMR.
What was the serious condition that they had at the time that CMR was granted to them?
Severe diabetes.
Is that morbid, a severe condition requiring CMR release? It doesn't seem to reach that level.
Well, Your Honor, keep in mind there were 2,200 individuals applied for CMR and only 150 were chosen. So one assumes that the DOC followed the statute and applied the statute accordingly, which required selecting individuals.
Here's my point, counsel. I don't think and pregnancy certainly isn't inherent. Well, pregnancy can be a dangerous situation, but in and of itself, it's not inherently dangerous, nor is diabetes. Those conditions became dangerous because of the underlying condition that we all were under with respect to the COVID-19 pandemic. And it seems that the DOC looked at that and said, that is part of the medical condition. And now that that condition is gone, you no longer meet that first requirement.
Well, Your Honor, our position is that the CMR statute should be interpreted as written, which requires that your intrinsic medical condition have improved. So,
but if that's the case, then would you agree then that the DOC should not have given them any release because they didn't have a medical condition that met that statute?
My position is they did have medical, they did have very serious, grave medical conditions.
Which was what?
Well, myasthenia gravis was a very serious condition that one individual had. Somebody had COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disorder. I mean, these are serious, grave conditions.
Right, but
Your Honor,
those conditions that the DOC typically grants CMR for, with putting aside the COVID-19 pandemic?
Not typically, Your Honor, but...
And that's my point.
Yes.
I think it has to be looked at in the context of what was going on at the time.
Well, Your Honor, if we're going to interpret the statute as the medical condition vis-a-vis the situation at the time, keep in mind there's a second prong to the statute, which is also that the person has now become a more serious risk to the public. So there are serious questions as to whether the DOC considered that second prong as part of its analysis here. Certainly, the district court is not satisfied completely that this process passes muster and was about to hold a hearing on the matter. The hearing would have been held in January of this year, and then were we back before Your Honors, you would have had the benefit of a much more developed record. The district court decided in its wisdom and in its discretion that there needed to be further development to determine whether the process followed by the DOC here, the new individualized process post-complaint, satisfy the statute and due process.
I've heard you address the concerns about statutory compliance by the DOC with their new procedure. Would you also address the likelihood of the merits, success on the merits, as to your constitutional argument?
Well,
I assume it's different.
Well, Your Honor, the due process clause will require that the DOC follow its the statute, but in addition, broader due process allows for an opportunity to respond to the agency decision, whether we're getting a formal, full-blown hearing or not.
Well, there was an opportunity to respond, wasn't there, to the DOC's decision to return to prison, to cease the CMR for the four individuals that we're talking about. Maybe it's only three now.
Your Honor, once the decision was made, we did not have an opportunity to go back and respond to the letter that had been given to us laying out all the reasons for
why. So it's a post-decision response that you're looking for, because there was an opportunity to respond before the decision was made, correct?
Well, when the DOC decided to institute its new individualized review, it took off the table the original decisions to return the 18 or 19 individuals who were the subject of our TRO. So we were back now with an opportunity to go and present our materials to the DOC. We presented our materials. I will say we were not given a huge amount of time, and we asked for more time and was denied. But we presented our materials. We did not get to see the materials relied upon by the DOC. We just simply got a letter laying out for us the reasons behind the DOC's decision. And so we did not get an opportunity to go back to them and say, we disagree with this, and we would like to see your underlying medical data for reaching this decision.
And what's your best authority for the requirement that, your argument that that's what exactly what constitutional due process requires?
Well, we would say that that the due process clause would at least give us an opportunity to respond to the agency's
post-decision.
Post-decision, yes.
And what's your legal authority for that? Yeah, thank you.
Well, Your Honor, I guess it's not necessarily, I don't want to say necessarily post-decision. I would just say that we would like we would seek an opportunity to be able to review the materials relied upon by the DOC.
So prior to decision.
Prior to the decision.
And also a
little opportunity of some sort of back and forth, that it's not just some opaque black box that we have no idea what's going on behind the scenes.
Sure. And your legal authority for that, then?
Your Honor, we would say under the Morrissey decision, we would submit that that would at least entitle us to have some notice of what's being used to decide to return our individuals into a carceral environment as opposed to the home confinement.
And how do you respond to the DOC's argument that the Morrissey case really isn't very close to this one? And again, I'm just focused on the Dahlberg factor, you know, reasonable likelihood of success on the merits as opposed to the actual merits.
And I would also say the Dahlberg factor in this case, because we establish irreparable harm, is simply a doubtful showing of success. For the DOC to prevail on that Dahlberg factor, they have to show there's no likelihood of success on the merits. And so I submit that we have a situation here where the medical condition has not improved. If indeed the statute is going to be interpreted as medical condition vis-a-vis surrounding circumstances, which we would dispute, then they still have to find that the person has now become a more serious threat to the public. And in fact, if anything, the threat, as we laid out in our papers, the threat to the public would be more serious after such a lengthy period of being free and in the community, connecting and bonding with family.
So, Counsel, what I struggle with when you move to that part of your argument is that does sound like an individualized determination. It will be made person by person whether that medical condition has met this, is at the statutory standard for continuing medical release or for returning to prison. So that does sound like a different challenge, not a constitutional challenge, constitutional sufficiency or adequacy challenge.
Well, the constitutional challenge is to the nature of the process and the level of notice and opportunity we had to engage on the decision to return these individuals to prison. The statute itself requires an individualized review with two very particular requirements to be met, which we submit based on what we've seen from the materials from the DOC. They didn't apply that standard because they applied a very different standard. They applied the standard that it's approved vis-a-vis vaccines and treatments and seemed to have essentially ignored the concept of serious risk to the public. The issue seemed to be simply serving your sentence, and the finality of sentences was the only factor considered in that second prong.
And what's the basis for that assumption?
Because this is based on materials provided by the DOC in individual letters to the respondents and filings in the district court, where they talk about the need for respect for the sentence and the kind of sentencing factors of deterrence and incapacitation, but not individualized findings with respect to the individuals as to their threat to the public.
So is that information the information that was provided at the district court, or is that information that had been provided to respondents before the process that had been used by the DOC?
This was in filings to the district court, Your Honor.
Okay, so that's not information that you were provided.
Nothing that we were provided indicated the analysis on serious threat to the public, other than you now need to serve your sentence. So we submit that there wasn't an individualized analysis of the threat that individual posed, and if any... Your Honor, I see that I'm out of time, so...
You may finish your
talk. And I think if there were ever a case where the threat issue was not addressed is in the case of Tanya Wagner, who now would be separated from a baby that would end up with severe attachment disorder if she was returned to prison, and thus creating a huge public safety risk down the road, and as set forth in a filing that we submitted from a forensic psychiatrist. Your Honor, with that, we ask that you affirm the district court's decision and return this matter to the district court for additional fact-finding.
Thank you. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. The record does show, and it is in the addendum to our appellate brief, that the Department of Corrections did look at that second prong. And was very clear and wrote out its reasoning in its letter to the recipients. So, for instance, Mr. Barnes, the commissioner looked at the seriousness of the commitment offense and his noncompliance with release conditions. There are other folks who had been using and
selling methamphetamine. There was a respondent who left the state without telling their agent. So certainly, it's not that the department skipped that prong. My concern here goes back to...
I do have a question about that. Were there any proceedings instituted, probation or parole violation, I'm sorry, probation violation, violations filed or hearings held on any of those?
So some of these folks are what are called restructured. And the reason they were restructured is because during COVID, for all, not just folks on conditional medical release, but also folks who are on supervised release, to the extent that folks could be restructured and not revoked, that's what the DOC was doing because they were trying to keep the prison population down. The whole reason for conditional medical release in the this particular kind of conditional medical release in the first place. And I think we all can concede that this wasn't a great fit, that this statute was not a super great fit for what the commissioner was trying to do, which was to reduce the population in the prisons. But everybody was on notice about what the parameters around this were. So it should be no surprise that COVID-19 and the state of COVID-19 in the community had to be part of the calculus for whether or not these people's health conditions had improved. And again, it wasn't a great fit in the statute, but I don't think the respondents can pretend that everything was fine when they were let out under these kind of, you know, special conditions, right? But now they can't go back. I mean, again, it wasn't a great fit for the commissioner to use this, but I think this was all the commissioner had at the time. I will say that the legislature has acknowledged that the state needed to have something like this in place, and it has been amended, and it will be effective August 1st. And now the CMR statute does take into consideration not just when people are gravely ill, which is what it had always traditionally been used. It was like a hospice sort of thing, right? Like, you're gravely ill, and we want to give you the kind of treatment you deserve in the community. But it was always for folks who are really, like, kind of on their deathbed. And so now the legislature sees that the state needs something else that can help during an epidemic or a pandemic. And so there's a new session law, and I can cite that to the court, but I don't think it affects what we're doing today. But I do just want to say that the legislature acknowledged that using CMR this way, probably it wasn't a great fit. It was kind of a mess. And I think everybody's just trying to deal with it the best they can. It was definitely a unicorn in the sense that I hope we don't have another pandemic soon. And if we do, I think we have a better statute to handle that. But I do want to go back to the idea of, it seems to me the respondents want the district court to wade into the things that I think separation of powers absolutely says the district court shouldn't wade into. And again, it's this calculus of like, well, are they really, you know, is this really a health condition? Should they really be thinking this health condition is worse? Should they be thinking about COVID-19? What was the commissioner's reasoning making these findings? And that really is an administrative law process. And I get that this is a difficult case because we started in district court. But once that administrative process was given to these folks, I do think that the district court no longer has a role here and does not have
such a... So what about the argument that appellant or respondent made that disclosure prior of the... the materials the DOC is relying on to make their decision should be provided as part of the process? I mean, that it wasn't provided, right, in this case?
That the DOC gave them information? Right, that there was some kind of almost like a mini discovery exchange or something like that. I don't know what to call it, but no, that didn't happen. And I think, you know, to the extent that this is more like a Matthews kind of argument that, like, well, you know, I deserve process.
Right, it is Matthews' argument. So what process is due? So again, we haven't had that decision yet. Is my only question to you? Yep. We haven't had that analysis done. Isn't that what this case gets remanded for in light of the district court's decision?
Yeah, I honestly don't think so. I think this pushes me back to habeas. I honestly think that you challenge if you go back to Schnagel.
But a habeas decision is an individualized decision per each prisoner.
Yep.
Right. And that's not the argument that I'm hearing from Respondents' Council. They are talking on a larger basis what process is required under this CMR statute, which maybe will not have a long-term impact if the CMR statute has been changed.
Boy, I hope not. Yeah. I think that they received adequate process under Matthews, right? Matthews says that you don't.
That's your opinion.
It is.
But we
opinion.
Don't have a district court decision on that yet, do we?
Well, we don't. But would a habeas court decision work? Because, you know, they can appeal habeas to this court as well. I mean, I don't know why a constitutional decision from a habeas court when we have folks who are supposed to be in prison isn't where you get that answer.
But they're not in prison anymore.
but they should be. They should be serving their term of imprisonment in prison. That I understand. I understand your point, Your Honor. Thank you. I see my time is up. Are there any other questions? We do ask, if I didn't ask at the beginning, that the court reverse and vacate the TRO and with directions to the district court to dismiss the matter. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, counsel, for both parties for your oral arguments. They were very well done. We appreciate it. Welcome. We're looking forward to seeing you before us arguing more in the future. And thank you for the briefing as well. The briefing was very well done.